This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. To support the production of content like this, donate at cbf.com.au.
Dennis Altman is one of Australia's most iconic LGBTIQ plus rights activists. He's written many, many books, including Homosexual, Oppression and Liberation, AIDS in the Mind of America, The End of the Homosexual, and Queer Wars. He's also been present for some of the most iconic events in LGBTIQ plus history, many of which we'll ask him about. He was present for the protests that ultimately led to the first Mardi Gras, lived in New York during the first years that HIV and AIDS emerged in the 1980s, and has met and been friends with an enormous range of celebrities and luminaries from our community and beyond, including Gore Vidal, Jermaine Greer, and many, many more. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us here on The Informer.
Dennis?
I've already said how pleased I am to be here. Okay, I'm saying it again. I love being here in my favourite studio in Bourke Street.
We'll welcome you as many times as necessary.
Yeah, this has been one of those shows as well where we've been trying to respond to very fluid news in the form of the debate that's happening in the Victorian Parliament. We will get to some sections of that a bit later on in the show. So, Dennis, a major theme of Unrequited Love is your relationship with the United States, And you've spent substantial periods of your life living in the United States. You actually had a chance to get a green card, but you ultimately chose to return home, unlike many Australians.
Yeah, you know, I think the choice was I could either stay in the United States and become an American citizen, or I could stay in the United States and be permanently a foreigner. And neither of those appealed to me. And I think that the attraction of coming back to Australia was complicated. There were a number of issues. But I think a lot of it had to do with being the son of refugees. Mm. And I think that being the son of refugees, and both my parents came to Australia separately, but essentially as refugees, I think that gives you a particular sense of belonging. And I have a very strong memory of a dinner in New York, a Thanksgiving dinner, where everybody except me could reminisce about their student youth in the US. And I realised, however long I lived there, I wouldn't have those shared memories. Mm-hmm. Nobody I would go to dinner with in the US would have listened to the Argonauts, as I did when I was a kid. Now, you're all too young probably to have listened to the Argonauts, but there was this sense of belonging that I think drew me back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you talk about unrequited love, is that partly because of the fact that the way you see the US has changed over the years, or do you think that's always been the way that America has seen Australia as a slightly, you know...
Well, it's not how America sees Australia as much as how we see the United States. I think that the idea of unrequited love is that you yearn, you love, you want recognition. And the Australian attitude to the United States is very much that, both at an individual level. I mean, most of us still have those words of the song, you know, if you make it New York, you've made it anywhere. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, at a national level, we have a bipartisan history of prime ministers going far beyond the national interest in their love for the United States. And my sense is that love is unrequited. They do not respond to us with the yearning and the sense of commitment that we extend to them. Mm-hmm. And so I would say the unrequited love is both a description of my own attitude towards the United States, which certainly is probably now in the Trump era far less positive than it would have been a couple of years ago, but it's also a reflection of the larger Australian attitude to the United States. And, you know, it was a good title. There are lots of books out there called Unrequited Love, and all the others are Harlequin novels. And I guess I'm hoping this is going to get my book into all those wonderful newsstands in news agencies around the country, and people are going to think they're getting a bodice ripper.
I like that. That's very savvy marketing.
Yeah. On Australia's relationship with America, you point out that five generations of governments here have sent troops to Afghanistan as part of NATO, a North Atlantic alliance, but also note that Australia is now in Eurovision. Do we have to give up Eurovision if we decide not to go along with the US's little romp?
No. I mean, the interesting thing, of course, is we're in Eurovision and they're not, right? The US doesn't care about Eurovision. And in fact, I don't think the Americans could take part in Eurovision, not because geography isn't fluid. I mean, if Australia can be part of Eurovision, anybody can be part of Eurovision. But I don't think Americans could contemplate the idea that an American singer would have to compete with, I don't know, someone from Moldova. You know, this is beyond their comprehension. Now, I was making a serious point. NATO is, after all, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And yet we have, and you're right, under five prime ministers, starting back with Howard, we have committed troops and kept troops in Afghanistan in a war that clearly has changed very little. That has cost a huge amount of human carnage and probably will result eventually, or maybe fairly soon, in a withdrawal of Allied forces, leaving the situation much as it was at the beginning. But yes, I think that it's a very good example of our willingness to follow the US without thinking through our own regional position.
You're listening to The Informer. We're talking to Dennis Altman, a gay activist and writer. Dennis, you're speaking about an unrequited love that we have with America, and you could certainly probably draw some parallels between the Australian government and the US government. Do you think that Trump's election is what allowed the Morrison government to get up?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think that had Hillary Clinton been elected in 2016, Malcolm Turnbull would not have been removed. And the reason I think that is that the election of Trump gave oxygen to the right wing in the Liberal Party on two big issues. One was on climate change and coal, where, after all, Clinton would not have pulled out of the Paris Agreement, and she would have pushed for international action on climate change. And the other was on sort of larger cultural war issues, where, again, the right and the Liberal Party strongly disliked Malcolm Turnbull, despite all his attempts to give them what they wanted. So my hunch is it would have changed the dynamics within the Liberal Party. Now, what then would have happened, I don't know. I think, yes, in a different world, it's possible that the sort of moderate social democratic appeal of Bill Shorten would have been stronger. And I certainly could imagine that Shorten campaigning in a world where the United States was under President Clinton would have done better than Shorten having to campaign in a world dominated by President Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. There is this strange sense as well, and I think this is true in Australia and in the United States, of when you look at wars, the wars, for example, in Iraq, and you look at a lot of the media coverage of the growth of ISIS. It's kind of incredible the lack of reflection on the part of the various governments that were involved in effectively dismantling a whole variety of institutions and states that existed in that region and creating this kind of massive maelstrom of insecurity. And the founders of ISIS literally met in an American prison. And it's something that I think the vast majority of people are totally unaware of. Why do you think we are so blithe when it comes to, like, we go from Iraq is a big deal, Saddam Hussein, we've got a, you know, like, we're so interested and engaged with this, to goodness me, look at these awful, where did this, well, terrible, you know, like, there's no sense of moral responsibility. Do you think, has that changed over your kind of lifetime, or is that a new thing?
My generation came of age politically in the shadow of Vietnam, and we're just actually moving out of a period in which our politics are dominated by people who came into maturity in the age of Vietnam. I think that a lot of it does clearly go back to some very deep sense of insecurity and the belief that the United States will protect us. And therefore, if the United States takes an action, we need to be there to prove to them that we're their friends. And we're seeing this at the moment acted out. Scott Morrison has clearly been very successful in winning the friendship of Donald Trump. I'm not sure that speaks highly for Scott Morrison, because, after all, Kim Jong-un has also been very successful in winning the good graces of Donald Trump. I would have thought, if I was Scott Morrison, I would be very wary, and I would look at some of the other leaders who have won Trump over and then been dumped by him fairly dramatically, like Justin Trudeau or Emmanuel Macron. But I think this deep sense of insecurity that we have means that we unreflectively are drawn into foreign conflicts. And I must say, I'm very heartened by the fact that the current government, the Morrison government, is not rushing in to support a US initiative in the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. And the current Defence Minister, Linda Reynolds, has actually been on television a number of times saying this is a complicated issue, we have to think about this, we have to reflect on its consequences for us. I take that as a very good sign. Mm-hmm. And I do take some heart from the fact that I think Linda Reynolds and Maurice Payne, the foreign minister, are probably much more level-headed in their approach than some of their predecessors have been.
Do you think that some of that has come about because of the rise of China and that increasingly the Australian military is, pivoting back to ensure that we will actually be in a position to potentially respond to, you know, some of the different behaviours China is engaged in? Has that perhaps led to the military compared to, say, 15 years ago, being inclined to go along with these kinds of adventures that really take Australia far beyond our ostensible interests?
Well, clearly at the moment there is this tendency to talk about all foreign policy as being about the choice between the US and China. I think this is actually very dangerous. There are a lot of other countries between us and China, some of which are major players. I think that in general, I would be much happier if the Australian government worried a bit more about acting in cahoots or in concert with countries like Indonesia than they are worried about their relationship with the US and the UK. Mm-hmm. And I think that that shift, which we saw beginning under Keating, has unfortunately declined and under the current government just doesn't seem to be as prominent as has been in the past.
Mm, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Nick, are you?
You're listening to the Informer.
Speaking to Dennis. Yeah.
We are joined by the amazing Dennis Altman, a gay writer and activist who's been around for so many important historic events here. If you've got a question for Dennis, text in 0427-JOY-949. That's 0427-569-949. We'll be back with more.
You are listening to The Informer. My name is Toby Halligan. I'm here with Nick Hines, Nicholas Kamenya-Sendri and Dennis Altman. And we are talking to Dennis about a whole range of issues that he discusses in his wonderful book, Unrequited Love, Diary of an Accidental Activist. So, Dennis, to move things away from foreign policy, you talk about in the book how much has changed in terms of queer rights around the world. I think that particular reflection comes when you're at an event at Queer Zagreb and you're kind of talking about how much things have changed in Croatia and the Balkans generally, that gay marriage is now legal there. But it feels like it's fair to say that there is this kind of miasma of pessimism, if you like, to use quite a wanky phrase, that's fallen over, I think, both our community and a lot of progressives recently, despite all the progress. What do you think is driving that?
I'm not sure that there's pessimism. I think that there is probably a heightened awareness of remaining problems. But I think we've got to distinguish between two things. One is that people who want larger social change clearly feel in some ways disenfranchised by what happened at the last election. The last election, which is up for only a few months ago, was a time when we all expected that we would go through a shift in government and all the things that might flow from that, whether or not they would happen. Suddenly that's no longer the case. And the Conservative parties are entrenched. We have a government that is likely to be there now for at least 3 years, maybe longer. That, I think, overshadows the immediacy. Now, for queer communities, I think there is a huge amount to celebrate. And the pessimism that I feel is not about what's happening in Australia, where I think change is going on and going on fairly quickly in all sorts of ways. It's when we look globally. And the reality is that in many parts of the world, things are actually getting worse. If you go to our north, if you go to Indonesia, there has been a marked upsurge in the last few years in official homophobia, driven by government, driven by religious forces. That, to me, is a much bigger problem, a much bigger issue than anything we face now in Australia. Mm. I'm not sure that I want people to be pessimistic, though. I mean, I think that pessimism can be a very self-defeating feeling. I know I'm going to sound like a therapist now, and
that's
I'm
okay.
Not.
Like this episode of The Informer can range across a whole range.
Well,
of,
indeed,
you know, psychotherapy.
And, you know,
you've got a question for Dennis? it's yes, your relationship with your father, Jack, in wherever.
But what does strike me is there's a certain degree of almost glee in finding a victim status, in hunting up every example of homophobia. And while I understand why people are doing this, it seems to me this is very self-defeating. I would much rather we actually spend that energy highlighting the positive steps. And in fact, the debate that's going on in the Victorian Parliament as we sit here, or possibly not, they're probably having dinner, which we're not, but anyway, the current debate on birth certificates and trans issues is, I think, a mark of how far we've come. That debate literally would not have been imaginable even a decade ago. And I think it's very important that we remember that, and we remember and look at the number of people who now are trying to rectify injustices of the past.
And you sort of speak in your book about how the gay rights movement of the 20th century was focused on sort of overthrowing structural norms that allowed for homophobia and discrimination, and yet you talk with almost, it reads as disappointment that the current gay rights movement is focused more on assimilation, arguably. What's your read on, even with the debate before Parliament, but especially with the religious freedom debate going on, what would you like to see the gay rights movement be doing in that space?
Well, the religious freedom debate is a really interesting one because we've already had major demonstrations against a bill. We don't know what the bill is going to say. And this strikes me as rather perverse. I'm not prepared to go out in the streets unless I know what it is I'm demonstrating against. I would like, in this case, let's talk about that because I think that is clearly going to be a big issue with this current government. And there's no doubt there are people in the current government, including the Prime Minister, who do want to impose certain sorts of religious-based doctrines on the rest of us. But essentially, the real issue is not whether or not people have the right to believe whatever it is they want to believe. Of course they do. And that's never been queried. The question is, how far does that right allow them to impose their views on other people? And to me, the really big problem in Australia goes far beyond LGBT rights. It's the reality that we live in a country that has a remarkably high number of kids going to fundamentalist religious schools. Fundamentalist, whether it's Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, I don't care. To me, there is something very, very dangerous about the fact that we allow so many kids to be brought up in schools that teach a very narrow, religiously defined set of principles, and more importantly, don't encourage mixing beyond those particular communities. And what I'd really like to see the religious freedom debate turn into is a real debate about why on earth do we maintain such extraordinary support for church-based schools?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and there are so many branches of that as well. Like there are policies, for example, the school chaplain's policy that got quietly right before
yes.
the budget
yes.
Refunded effectively for another 3 years. It seems like there is this profound discomfort amongst the coalition with the state propping up private organisations unless they happen to be religious schools. What would you like to see in terms of how we change the support structures or how we approach the way we fund education?
Well, look, I think there's what we might practically talk about and there's what I would idealistically like. You us old radicals like dreaming big, right? Thanks, Nick. I mean, dreaming big, I actually would like a system where at some point for a couple of years in every kids' education, they went to a state institution. I think that then there are two reasons I want that. One is it would immediately break down the sorts of barriers, whether they're of class, ethnicity, or religion, that separate kids at school. Secondly, and probably even more important, if all the kids had to go into the state system at some point, suddenly there would be massive support for funding the state system. Now, at a practical level, because I know that this is not a policy that Anthony Albanese is sitting at the end of his at the end of his radio writing down with eagerness to introduce, at a practical level, we could at least do something about the extraordinary funding models that allow private schools that are already very well endowed, that are catering for wealthy parents, to get more money from the government. And I think there have been enough stories. I don't need to go into that. The lavishness of equipment, of swimming pools, of gymnasia, of theatres in some of the most elite private schools compared with what's available to a kid who goes to the local state school in an outer suburb or a country town, it is quite extraordinary. And, of course, it perpetuates the class division that is essentially there. Now, I know in the current Australia, to say there is class division means I will immediately be accused. I hope I get an editorial in The Australian accusing me of fomenting class warfare. But I think we have to, you know, the facts are fairly obvious.
Speaking of class warfare, you talk about populism in the book and the way we often define it inaccurately. How do we define it inaccurately? And do you think that Scott Morrison is a populist?
Yeah, it's an interesting term, isn't it? Because populism sort of means an appeal to the people without any intermediate institutions. So the idea that somehow the masses should speak, and it's never quite clear how they should speak. But someone like Donald Trump is a populist because he has such contempt and he's willing to express such contempt for the institutions of the United States system. He has contempt for Congress, he has contempt for the court, he makes clear he has contempt for the press. I don't think in that sense Scott Morrison is a populist. Where I think one might say Scott Morrison possibly whistledogs a bit to populists is that while I don't think Scott Morrison is a racist, and I think we should be very careful before we allege anybody as a racist, it's certainly true that his party has been less willing to come down hard on people who are racist than they are, for example, in their attacks on the Greens. And when you get, as you do quite frequently, Liberal MPs, National MPs, saying the Greens are a greater threat to Australians, to Australian life than One Nation, then I think that is an appeal to the worst sort of populism, namely some sort of mythical idea of the people who are then defined as white and the real Australians turning against everybody who doesn't fit that image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is this sense too that something that has changed many of those dynamics is the growth of social media. One of the things that's lovely about the book is because it's in a diary format, you kind of describe, you know, like a whole variety of experiences you've had where you've kind of, you know, been going out to events or just wandering around cities. There's this really lovely anecdote, actually. I'm trying to remember the German city you're in. I think it's Hamburg, or where there was a German couple nearby that were, you presumed a heterosexual couple, but then kind of a man appeared to walk past, and through your eavesdropping, you thought, oh, is this, do you know what I mean? Like, is this a lover of one member of the couple? You seem very, very observant. Have you always been this observant? Like, how did you... Where did this come from?
It's interesting. I think I observe some things and other things I don't observe at all. Mm. I know there's a moment which suddenly struck me. I was writing about the time I went... I'm going to do some name-dropping because that's what authors do. I went and had lunch with James Baldwin, who had a house in the French countryside, inland from Nice. And when I started writing about that, what I remembered were the colours. And what really struck me was how rarely I actually remember colour, how rarely I would notice gardens. I'm not one of those people who can go somewhere and come back and say, you know, I saw all these flowers, I could describe the architecture, I could describe the furniture in the room, which, by the way, is something that really good novelists are particularly acute at doing. So I think that the observations in Unrequited Love are probably pretty fragmentary, and often they are because something happened that made an event stick in my mind or a place stick in my mind. It's also true, you know, like most academics, I'm a failed novelist, and I think I quite deliberately wanted to write a book that reads as if it's a novel, certainly not a book that reads as if it's a text.
Mm. Yeah, I think reading the novel, you really get that fragmented sense.
The diary.
Not a novel. But it almost reads as a novel, it just in the way that you've conveyed that fragmented sense of memory, and it reads almost as such an incredible history of the gay rights movement, because you seem to be everywhere all at once. And it's just astounding how many things you've experienced.
Oh, this is age. You know, you wait.
I'm excited to, if I can just do half of what you've done. But you obviously, you've sort of broken the gays down into three generations in the book. The gay liberationists of the 70s, the ones who lived through the AIDS crisis in the 80s and 90s, and now the ones who sort of are growing up outside of that fear. Do you have any sort of sense of, obviously now, like myself coming to 25, there's almost a generation below me. Have you got a read of what's next in that regard?
I don't, because I think one of the things I've learnt is how bad I am at predictions. But I think clearly the shifts that have gone on because of the internet, because of the ways in which people communicate, are so massive that we're really only beginning to come to terms with them. And in fact, although you and Toby are sort of suggesting I give a lot away, I'm actually quite discreet about, for example, some of the things I could have written about adventures on sexual apps. But what strikes me, I've just come back from Europe, and I was in Qatar for 24 hours. And as all good gay men do, I went on the internet. I hasten to say I was not silly enough to actually want to try and hook up with anyone in Qatar. I wasn't ruling it out. That wasn't what I was there for. I was just interested in who was online. And what struck me was the sheer number of people and the way in which people in very repressive parts of the world, and it wasn't just Qatar, it was the surrounding Emirates and Saudi Arabia and Iran, probably the most repressive part of the world if you're homosexual. What really struck me was the way in which social media and the internet gives guys access that just was inconceivable, what, 20 years ago. The fact that we live in this world means that I think the next generations are going to experience that world very differently. And I certainly can't predict it. I think that you're quite right. I do talk about three generations, but those are three generations defined by what I suppose was one of the defining moments for me and will be for a lot of men listening, less so for women, namely the AIDS epidemic, and the fact that a whole generation of people died. And that is something that I think hung over me as I was writing the book more than I probably anticipated.
You're right. And do you think as well, I mean, and Nick kind of alluded to this before, that in terms of the different generations, there are this... what's the right way to frame this up? This the ability for different generations of, in particular, you know, everyone here is a gay man, how we kind of have grown up, because you grew up kind of during the sexual liberation era and then during that second period when people were kind of coming out effectively, the AIDS epidemic struck. And to people growing up, you know, my age, you know, I'm 35, AIDS was there, it was present, but it was just not the same. Do you think that inhibits or changes how the different generations speak to one another?
Well, I think the question of how generations speak to each other is very interesting, because my sense is that younger queers, and I'm now including everybody who define themselves as queer, are actually much more generous with older queers than my generation was. I mean, the problem was, for people like me, we didn't have role models. I mean, I was very lucky, if I look back, and that's probably why I talk about a few well-known, established writers, because I was very lucky to meet people like Gore Vidal and Christopher Isherwood and James Baldwin, and they had a huge impact on me, much greater, obviously, than I could have had on them. But that was unusual. I mean, the reason I sought them out was precisely there weren't role models. There weren't older people around. Now, of course, that's not the case. Nor were there images in the way that there now are in film, on television, and, of course, on the internet. And I tell the story in the book, I think, of my nephew, who was then still at school, a Catholic school, interestingly, just turned 17, and he came out to his parents, and his mother rang us, My partner Anthony was then still alive, and his mother rang Anthony to tell him that Peter had come out. And at that moment, we were watching the episode of Glee where Kurt comes out to his father. Now, you couldn't really invent... You could invent it, and people would say, oh, that's shonky, you know, but it actually happened.
You are listening to The Informer. We're here with Dennis Altman. We're just going to take a track. We've been talking about Donald Trump and a lot of gay history, so it only seems appropriate to play The Village People's Macho Man. You are listening to Joy. It is 12 minutes to 8.
We've got Dennis Altman here. Going to ask him one last question. You talk in the book about Sydney being gay, but Melbourne being queerer. How is Melbourne queerer?
Well, look, Sydney has Mardi Gras. We bravely march down Fitzroy Street in the middle of the day. On the other hand, we have the coming back out ball. And I write about the coming back out ball and Tristram Neacham's extraordinary work in the book. And I think that by itself gives Melbourne the crown.
That's extraordinary. Dennis, thank you as well for the brief answer, because we are running out of time. We're lucky we get to hand over to Trans POV. The book is Unrequited Love, Diary of an Accidental Activist. You can buy it at all good bookstores, and there will be events rolling out. Thank you so much to everyone who contributed to tonight's show, Arian Ponce, Thomas Fonts, for that excellent excellent interview. We were going to touch on the Victorian parliamentary debate, but we will be covering that properly next week when we have a clearer result. This has been The Informer. I have been Toby Halligan. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.